Wow. Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out. You guys may find this funny, but as much as I'm focused on the message that I want to deliver to you guys today, this morning, I was more focused on getting the pronunciation of pecan correct. So I'm originally from Atlanta. We say pecan there. So I just want to make sure I got that pronunciation correct. Because I figure if I get that wrong, they probably won't listen to another word I have to say. But thank you all. I want to say good morning also to those who may be listening and watching online. Thank you all for coming out this morning. We appreciate so much Trey's hospitality and inviting us out to the church at Pecan Creek. And so we're really excited to be here. I want to speak on behalf of my brother Virgil. Really excited to be here. I just want to commend you all. I don't mean to embarrass anyone here, but I really want to commend you and your leadership here at Pecan Creek for having the courage to be able to confront some of the issues that Virgil and I are going to talk about this morning proactively and aggressively and through a biblical worldview. You really are unique in that regard because in the travels that Virgil and I engage in, we travel all over the country. it's really sad how many churches are caving to these worldly ideologies such as critical race theory, intersectionality, liberation theology. I could go on and on. But your leadership here, as well as yourselves, are to be commended. Even if it wasn't Virgil and me up here speaking to you today, to bring in solid speakers who believe in the sufficiency of Scripture to address these issues because we believe Scripture is sufficient. So thank you all again for coming out. I'm going to be talking to you this morning on the interconnectedness of critical race theory and Marxism. The interconnectedness of critical race theory and Marxism. And why I find this topic important is because if you listen to the critical race theory apologists, one of the first things they'll try to convince you of is that critical race theory has nothing to do with Marxism. They will try to tell you that. That is one of the defense mechanisms that makes them stiffen up. They'll automatically stiffen up if you try to associate critical race theory with Marxism, because the lie that they try to tell you, the lie that they want you to believe, is that critical race theory is just about teaching history. Well, it's not. Okay? It's not. And I want to talk to you about why it's not this morning, okay? So, again, I'm thankful that this is being recorded. That's going to benefit you because today, I'll just tell you up front, Virgil and I come, and you guys will appreciate this in Texas, we come fully loaded. Okay? We come fully loaded. If any of you are familiar with the Just Thinking podcast, you realize we don't dumb down anything. So for you who are here today who are parents of young children, we'll just rely on you to go back and decipher what you hear this morning for the sake of your children. But we assume that everyone here is intelligent enough and mature enough to handle what we're going to talk about. So get ready, okay? So the interconnectedness of critical race theory and Marxism. Now, when it comes to understanding critical race theory, what you and I must initially realize is that critical race theory, or CRT for short, is not some kind of Big Bang proposition. And what I mean by that is that critical race theory as a worldview is not a belief system that has come about ex nihilo. Ex nihilo is a Latin phrase that means out of nothing. Critical race theory is not a belief system that has come out of nothing. It is not some sort of Big Bang idea that just came out of nowhere. Critical race theory has a definitive genesis, and that genesis begins with a worldview that was originally advanced by two 19th century German philosophers, Karl Marx, who lived from 1818 to 1883, and Friedrich Engels, who lived from 1820 to 1895. That worldview is known as Marxism. There's an ideological umbilical cord, if you will, that inexorably connects critical race theory with Marxism. That connection is a mutual disdain of and contempt for capitalism. Like Marxism, critical race theory views capitalism as the fundamental cause of racism in America. That's because in critical race theory, capitalism is what breeds white supremacy. Just yesterday, Black Lives Matter on Twitter tweeted this. Capitalism is the enemy of black people. Now, again, those of you who have listened to the Just Thinking podcast will know that last year we released two episodes on Black Lives Matter, a total of 6 hours of content on Black Lives Matter. The first episode was Black Lives Matter with a question mark, 3.5 hours long. The next episode was the Church of BLM, 3 hours long. First episode, we gave you an expositional overview of how BLM is organized. The second episode, the Church of BLM, we took you through the religious and spiritual dimensions that guide and undergird the leadership of that organization. Those two episodes together made such an impact that maybe about a month or so after they were released, Black Lives Matter ended up cleaning a lot of that stuff off of their website. So just yesterday, they tweet from the Black Lives Matter Twitter page, a verified Twitter account, that capitalism is the enemy of black people. So what did I do, the troublemaker that I am? A quote tweet is that you're retweeting what they tweeted, but you can add your own commentary to what they're doing. So I'm quoting their tweet, but I'm adding my own commentary. So for BLM to say that capitalism is the enemy of black people, so what I did, I quote tweeted them, and then I just list about the names of about nine black millionaires over history. I'm not talking about current day. I go all the way back to the 1800s. And I give them name after name after name after name to debunk what they just said. And this is what you have to do. I'm off my notes right now. But this is what you have to do. You have to be, number one, you have to be willing to call them out on their lies. Black America is no stranger to capitalism. There have been millionaires before there was LeBron James, before there was Oprah. There were black millionaires immediately out of the Reconstruction era. Okay? But you have to be willing to do the homework. So you just can't let Black Lives Matter, a lie like that, go unaddressed. So I called them out on it. And I think they're probably familiar with who Virgil and I are because the two episodes that we released on them last year exposed them for who they really are. So much so, they went out and said, well, we got to clean this stuff up because they're citing our website. They cleaned up, they whitewashed their whole website. You wouldn't recognize it now. So in critical race theory, capitalism is the enemy. Capitalism is fundamentally the enemy. In CRT, capitalism is what breeds white supremacy. And it's white supremacy, that critical race theorists, or crits, as they call it. So if you hear me use the term crits, that's just a shortened version for advocates of critical race theory. It's white supremacists that critical race theory, or crits, as they're often referred to, purportedly desire to dismantle in society. So everything's about white supremacy, and crits say, well, we want to do away with white supremacy. Like Marxism, critical race theory is fundamentally a philosophy of class struggle in which the oppression, injustice, and inequality of capitalism must be replaced with a more just, equitable, and inclusive system, namely socialism. Marxist professor Dr. Epifanio San Juan Jr. expresses that vision quite explicitly in a 2005 white paper published in the Michigan Journal of Race and Law titled From Race to Class Struggle, Reproblematizing Critical Race Theory, in which he states this, quoting Dr. Epifanio San Juan Jr., quote, a study of racist practices and institutions divorced from the underlying determinant structure of capital accumulation and class rule which allow such practices and institutions to exercise their naturalizing force. Let me pause right here. Now, don't blame me, but you're going to hear me quote a lot of Marxist socialist academicians. That what they say doesn't make sense isn't my fault. But this is what people like Dr. Epifanio San Juan do. The stuff they write is at such a high academic level. It's because it's not for people like me and you. It's not for the average person. It's for their peers. Peers who share their worldview. So it's to help make their peers more robust as they try to impart their worldview onto the students that they teach. Okay? So what I'm quoting from Dr. Epifanio San Juan won't really make sense until I get to like the end of the quote. Then he starts speaking English. San Juan says, the study of racist practices and institutions divorced from the underlying determinant structure of capital accumulation and class rule. See, even in saying that, he's saying that capitalism is oppressive. Okay? So, and this is what you have to do, folks. You have to listen so closely to the vernacular that they use. Because if you're familiar with the wordings, the language that they use, you can decipher it. It's almost like a code that you have to decipher. So unless you know what Marxism is, and we'll talk about that more in a second, unless you know what Marxism is, then you would never understand why Dr. Epifanio San Juan associates capital accumulation with class rule. In his mind, the two go together. So that's what makes capitalism, by definition, oppressive in his mind. A study of racist practices and institutions divorced from the underlying determinant structure of capital accumulation and class rule, which allows such practices and institutions to exercise their naturalizing force, can only perpetuate an abstract metaphysics of race and a discourse of power that would reinforce the continuing reification or commodification of human relations in everyday life. Don't ask me what that means. Still quoting Dr. San Juan, we cannot multiply static determinations in an atomistic manner and at the same time acquire an intelligible totality of knowledge which we need for formulating strategies of radical social transformation. Now, whenever you hear that term, radical socialist, social transformation, translate socialism. A first step in this project of renewing critical race theory is simple to state but difficult to execute. Here's the money quote right here. We must begin with the concept, he's saying, in order to renew or to reproblematize critical race theory in society, we must begin with the concept of class as an antagonistic relation between labor and capital, and then proceed to analyze or criticize how the determinant of race is played out historically in the class-conflicted structure of capitalism and its political slash ideological processes of class rule. Now, unquote, by the way. Why was that the money quote? Because Dr. San Juan is saying here that in order to really leverage critical race theory towards the ends that we want, we have to leverage the Marxist concept of positing critical race theory as a struggle between classes, which is what Marxism fundamentally is. It is pitting groups and classes of people against one another under the presupposition that capitalism is evil. Okay? So when he says here that we must proceed to analyze or criticize, understand that the word critical in critical race theory doesn't mean analytical. It does not mean to analyze. It means to criticize. That's what critical means in critical race theory. It means to criticize everything through a racial lens. Dr. San Juan is emphatic that in order for critical race theory to be successful toward radical social transformation, it must mirror the same ideological concept upon which Marxism is built, the concept of class as an antagonistic relation between labor and capital. It is that same ideological interconnectedness that is expressed in a June 15, 2020 article on the website Marxism.com titled USA, Black Struggle and the Socialist Revolution, which states, quote, "The struggle against racism and discrimination is of crucial importance from revolutionary Marxists. We fight at all times against all forms of oppression and discrimination. But we do this while fighting for maximum unity of the working class across lines of gender, race, ethnicity, and religion, always linking this to the struggle for the revolutionary socialist transformation of society." Now, who did you just hear use that same terminology? It's Dr. Sam Warren. Radical social transformation. Except in this quote, they say revolutionary socialist transformation of society. It's the same thing. There is no solution within the limits of capitalism. It is above all a class question. Same argument that Dr. San Juan just made. It's a class question. And as always, we start with our general program. Our task as Marxists is to raise class unity, consciousness, and confidence. This is the same lie that crits tell. That we want critical race. Well, first of all, they went from, well, critical race theory is not being taught in the schools. Critical race theory is only being taught at the in legal academies. Now they're admitting that critical race theory is being taught K through 12. But the goal of critical race theory is just to bring about confidence in our students. We just want them to have confidence in themselves and who they are. So this guy says our task as Marxists is to raise class unity, consciousness, and confidence. We do not fight only for immediate gains, but also to raise the perspective and potential for plenty of jobs, healthcare, housing, and education for all under socialism. We do not merely seek a more fair division of capitalist scarcity. United class struggle is the only way forward. As a super exploited section of the population, black workers and youth will play a key role in the coming socialist revolution, unquote. So they're saying the quiet part out loud. Again, that was from the website Marxism.com in an article titled USA Black Struggle and the Socialist Revolution. Now, the statement, it is above all a class question, cannot be overemphasized because, like Marxism, critical race theory is fundamentally a philosophy of class struggle. Like Marxism, critical race theory views race, this is very important. If you don't remember a single syllable I say, remember this. Critical race theory, like Marxism, views race as a social construct. Race is social. In critical race theory. Critical race theory does not see race as a fixed, immutable, and static reality that is grounded in biology or science, or for that matter, theology, such as we find in Acts chapter 17, verse 26, which in the New American Standard Translation reads, "And he, that is God, made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation." It's important to note that in that verse in Acts 17:26, the Greek noun nation, so what you read in God made from one man every nation, the Greek noun nation there is the Greek word ethnos, from which we get our English word ethnicity. Ethnicity. So the correct term is ethnicity, not race. Not race. We have one human race. The word is genus, type. We are all one type, comprised of various ethnicities. I'll talk more about that in my message this afternoon. Critical race theory does not see race as a fixed, immutable, and static reality. It is a social construct. And understanding that critical race theory views race as a social construct is critically important, because to understand that is to also understand why critical race theory, not unlike Marxism itself, emphasizes the deconstruction of social institutions and structures that purportedly oppress different classes of people, such as blacks, Now you've got this term, Latinx, with an X on the end. LGBTQA2S. Did you realize they've added the 2S to the end of that now? Has anyone seen that? LGBTQA2S. And the plus, but the 2S means two-spirited. Two-spirit people. People who identify as having two spirits. Immigrants, transgenders, and various other intersectional categories of people whose alleged oppression is rooted solely in the greed and avarice of white supremacist capitalists. So when you understand the critical race theorists, they define race as a social construct. That's why race to them can mean anything. It can mean anything. Now, I just use one verse of scripture to establish to you that the proper biblical hermeneutic is ethnicity. It's not race. But critical race theorists view, they define their paradigm of race, in addition to being unbiblical, is totally changeable. It can mean one thing today, it can mean one thing tomorrow, another thing tomorrow. But it's social in that they see everything in society through a racial lens. That's why you hear so much about equity and equality. Because it's about outcomes. It's about outcomes. Viewing race as a fixed, objective, and immutable reality as opposed to a mutable, subjective, and societal reality doesn't get critical race theorists the eschatological world that they envision. This is why I say critical race theory is a worldview. They're after something. Critical race theorists want to change the world. This is why it's important to understand that the article that I quoted from Dr. Epifiano San Juan Jr. was titled Reproblematizing Critical Race Theory. So what he's saying there is that we need to find another way to use critical race theory as an argument for the problems that we see in society. We need to reproblematize CRT so that it gets us what we want. But see, understand, viewing race as a biological fixed reality doesn't get crits what they want. So they have to see race as a social construct, because then they can argue, well, we need to deconstruct this system. We need to deconstruct that institution. This system is racist. That entity is racist. We need to tear that down and then rebuild it and replace it. So that's what I mean. When they say race is a social construct, that's what I mean. Okay? That you live in a better zip code than me is racist. You guys must be redlining here in Texas. See? That's what a social construct looks like. And this is why you need to understand that, that the word critical in critical race theory means to criticize. Criticize everything. Everything's racist. So it doesn't get critical race theorists the eschatological world that they envision, which is precisely why I argue that critical race theory is a worldview. I say that in light of what Dr. Epifiano San Juan Jr., whom I quoted earlier, writes in a 2005 white paper published in the Michigan Journal of Racial Law again, Reproblematizing Critical Race Theory, and here he says it as about as plain as you can get. I'm quoting Dr. Epifiano San Juan in that same article, From Race to Class Struggle, Reproblematizing Critical Race Theory, where he says this, quote, "We need to reinstate the Marxist category of class derived from the social division of labor that generates antagonistic class relations. Class conflict becomes the key to grasping the totality of social relations of production, as well as the metabolic process of social reproduction in which racism finds its effectivity." Metabolic process, social reproduction, relations of production, all that's just gibberish for capitalism. He continues, "This will help us clarify the changing modes of racist practices, especially in the global market operations," again, just code for capitalism, where immigrant female labor plays a decisive role. I use the example of Filipino domestics as a global social class, again, creating a class of people. I use the example of Filipino domestics as a global social class actualized in its specific historical particularity as gendered, neo-colonized subjects of capital accumulation. Again, capitalism is oppressive. He uses Filipina female domestic workers to create a social class. He just creates one. And then he blames capitalism. He appends to capitalism all these adjectives, gender, neo-colonized, and says that these Filipino domestics are subjects of capital accumulation. He closes with this: critical race theory can be renewed by adopting class struggle as the means of resolving racial injustice through, here's the phrase again, radical structural transformation, unquote. So here you have Dr. San Juan, again, saying the quiet part out loud. We need to reinstate the Marxist category of class. And that's exactly what critical race theory has done. Critical race theory is all about class and putting people into different groups. This is why critical race theory is intersectional also. So you may see CRT, you may see CRT/I. It's intersectional. And this is why you have the plus. There's all kind of characters and special characters being added to this string of letters. And when you see that, what you have to understand, they're not just adding letters, they're creating classes of people. And they're pitting these classes against one another. They're pitting these classes of people against one another. This is what makes critical race theory analogous to Marxism, because Marxism is fundamentally, the cornerstone of Marxism is classism. It's classism rooted in a total rejection of capitalism. This is why Black Lives Matter could say what they did in that tweet. We quoted the three founders of Black Lives Matter. We quoted them in their own words, confessing that they are trained Marxists, quote unquote, trained Marxists. They said that with their own, in their own words. BLM is a Marxist organization. Objectively Marxist. Don't take my word for it. Do your own research. So you have to note in the quote that I just read you from Dr. San Juan that such phrases as antagonistic class relations, class conflict, and radical structural transformation is classic Marxist vernacular and accurately captures the teleology of critical race theory, which is to pit various classes of people against one another, particularly with regard to any socioeconomic distinctions that may exist between them, for the sole purpose of fostering antagonistic class relations toward the ultimate goal of radical structural transformation, which I said earlier is just code for socialism. That goal is precisely why statistics, particularly certain socio-ethnic economic data, are such a valuable weapon for crits. Crits subjectively use statistics as a means to promote the narrative that any socio-economic differences that may exist between blacks and whites in America are actually disparities that are the direct result of inequities brought about in society by an oppressive capitalistic system that is grounded in white hegemony. A prime example of that kind of subjective narratology can be found in a book which perhaps some of you have read, titled Divided by Faith, co-authored by Michael O. Emerson and Christian Smith, that was originally published more than 20 years ago. But I want you to understand something. I said a few minutes ago how important it is to pay attention to the language. With all due respect to Emerson and Smith, to view something as a disparity, which in reality is simply a difference or distinction, presupposes the existence of a universal standard of equality in which every person in society has the same amount of stuff, and that to not be able to acquire more of that stuff is to lay the blame at a systemically discriminatory policy or practice that adversely affects and impacts every person in precisely the same way. And we know that that doesn't happen. Now, not everything that is a difference or a distinction is a disparity. And what I'm arguing here is that you only have a disparity if you and I start off on the same, at the same place and the same level. And then something gets skewed. Okay? That's a disparity. But that you and I don't make the same amount of money, that you and I don't live in this equally as nice a house, that I don't, you drive, may drive a better car than me, that's not a disparity. It's just a difference. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's just a distinction. It's not a disparity. But critical race theorists will argue that all of those variances, if you will, are disparities caused by an oppressive white supremacist capitalist system. Which is why crits can just blast out white supremacy, white supremacy, white supremacy, white supremacy. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. And they don't have to prove it. Okay, so just understand that not every difference is a disparity. It's just a difference. It's just a distinction. The idea of socioeconomic equality, particularly as that concept is framed within a Marxian paradigm of what equality is and should look like, is precisely, I have to quote him again, Dr. Epifanio San Juan Jr. could say the following in an article he wrote titled "The Limits of Postcolonial Criticism," subtitled "The Discourse of Edward Said," where Dr. San Juan said this. Listen closely to this. Talk about something that doesn't make sense. Listen to this. Quote, "Capital ethnicizes people to promote labor segmentation, hybridity, and other differential phenomena result," unquote. So, this is why everyone in this room who is white is a white supremacist. Because you're a capitalist, and because capitalism ethnicizes people, according to Dr. San Juan, your being a capitalist is what makes you a white supremacist. So you're racist by virtue of existing. You're a racist because you exist. And because you're white and you exist. I don't know how much time you guys spend on social media. I'm on all the social media platforms, as is Virgil. I'm most active on Twitter. Virgil, you would say you're most active, you know, Twitter as well. If you spend enough time on Twitter, you can see folks who are socialist, Marxist, communist. They will tweet some unbelievable stuff, including that they want to see white people dead. They want white people done away with. So what you have to understand is when I quote people like, again, this is a Marxist professor at a university who says that capital ethnicizes people. So he's imparting to an ideology the ability to affect ethnicity in people. And then he's saying that ethnicity has the power to autonomously and independently create a mindset within you. But it's not the mindset that they're judging. It's your ethnicity that they're judging. So by your ethnicity, they're assuming your mindset. So by you being white, I'm assuming you hate me because I'm black. You're a supremacist. You want to oppress me. You want to hold me down because you're white. Critical race theory is a completely presuppositional worldview. It is totally presuppositional. When you start with a presupposition, you start with a conclusion that you don't have to prove. Because if you dare ask them to prove it, you're racist. or worse, you're a supremacist. So critical race theory is totally presupposition. You don't have to prove a thing. So again, in other, according to Dr. San Juan, capitalism is solely responsible for any socioeconomic differences that exist in America today, particularly between blacks and whites. Now, it may interest you to know, by the way, that neither socialism nor Marxism as ideological roadmaps to social justice are foreign to the pursuit of civil rights for blacks in America. Socialism, Marxism, and black civil rights are not strange bedfellows. Matter of fact, they're married to one another. For example, in a speech delivered to a group of striking railroad workers on July 22, 1877, a black socialist by the name of Peter Humphreys Clark, who at that time was principal of what was called the Colored High School in Cincinnati, Ohio. He was also the grandson of William Clark of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, said this, quote, "The government must control capital with a strong hand. It is merely the accumulated results of industry, and there would be no justice should a few score bees in the hive take possession of the store of honey and dole it out to the workers in return for services which added to their superabundant store. Yet such is the custom of society. Machinery and land will in time take the same course, and cooperation instead of competition will be the law of society. The miserable condition into which society has fallen has but one remedy, and that remedy is to be found in socialism." Unquote. That was Peter Humphreys Clark, a black socialist from July 1877. Another example is labor activist and politician Asa Philip Randolph, who lived from 1889 to 1979. Now, Randolph is one of the most significant yet least recognized leaders of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Though Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is widely and rightly lauded for his I Have a Dream speech delivered at what is called the March on Washington in August 1963, it is A. Philip Randolph who played a significant role in organizing that event in the first place, but nobody hears of A. Philip Randolph. Well, in Chapter 10 of the book titled Workers' Struggles, Past and Present, authored by Manning Marable, that last name is M-A-R-A-B-L-E, Manning Marable, titled A. Philip Randolph and the Foundations of Black American Socialism, Marable writes this, quote, "Randolph's personal background conformed in most respects to that of other first-generation black immigrants from the South. Born in Crescent City, Florida in 1889, he grew up in Jacksonville during the nadir of black-white relations. Inspired as a teenager by W.E.B. Du Bois's book, Souls of Black Folk, young Asa decided to leave the South and settle in New York City. Arriving in Harlem in the spring of 1911, Randolph first tried to become an actor. Failing at this, he drifted from one job to another. From 1912 to 1917, he attended courses at the City College of New York. A leftist philosophy professor by the name of J. Salwin Shapiro acquainted Randolph with Karl Marx's writings and other socialist literature. His, that is Randolph's, discovery of socialism was, quote, so exciting, unquote, that he later reflected that he studied, quote, Marx as children read Alice in Wonderland, unquote. He formed a group of radical free thinkers called the Independent Political Council and began to identify himself with Harlem's premier black socialist and, quote, leading street corner orator, unquote, Hubert Harrison, no relation, by the way. He, that is Randolph, joined the Socialist Party in the end of 1916 and began to lecture on black history and political economy at the Socialist Party's Rand School. By the beginning of World War I, Randolph and his new black friend, Chandler Owen, a fellow socialist, had become, quote, the most notorious street corner radicals in Harlem exceeding even Harrison in the boldness of their assault upon political and racial conditions in the country, unquote. Now, speaking of W.E.B. Du Bois, who at best was a Pan-Africanist, and Pan-Africanism fundamentally believed in the sort of recolonization of blacks from America back to Africa. And at worst, he was a socialist. W.E.B. Du Bois is particularly admired by critical race theorists today because of his emphasis on black power and autonomy. As Marxist professor Dr. Rayland Rabaka, director of the Center for African American Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, writes in Chapter 5 of the book titled The Handbook of Critical Race Theory in Education. By the way, do we have any educators in the room right now? If I had to recommend one resource for you as a teacher, if you really want to understand how critical race theory is advanced in schools, in public schools, get the book, The Handbook of Critical Race Theory in Education. The Handbook of Critical Race Theory in Education by Marvin Lynn and Adrian Dixon. The Handbook of Critical Race Theory in Education. Here's what Dr. Rayland Rabaka says in that book, in a chapter titled W.E.B. Du Bois' Contributions to Critical Race Studies in Education. Quote, Du Bois' sociology of education involves not only reclamation of African historical memory in the interest of radically re-educating critical educators and students about Africa's creation of and contributions to civilization, but also a struggle over the meaning of culture and cultural meanings. Now, let me pause here. This is the goal of critical race theory in the public school. It is to redefine and re-landscape the culture. It is to redefine and re-landscape the culture. Especially as that redefining and re-landscaping has to do with reshaping the minds of young black children and reorienting them from a Judeo-Christian capitalist paradigm of culture and society to a Pan-Africanist paradigm of society, which is inherently disdainful of white people. So when you hear a guy like Rayland Rabaka say, he affirms Du Bois' sociology because it has to do with radically re-educating critical educators and students about Africa's creation of and contributions to civilization, but also a struggle over the meaning of culture and cultural meanings. That phrase right there, that phraseology, the meaning of culture and cultural meanings, that's ultimately the goal of critical race theory. Continuing to quote Dr. Rayland Rabaka, in order to resist the imperialist impulse, that's more code for capitalism, in order to resist, and by the way, only a Marxist would use the word imperialist. Imperialist, imperialism, exclusively Marxist terminology. In order to resist the imperialist impulse, continental and diasporan Africans, along with other oppressed people, must do more than merely rediscover their long-hidden history. They are obliged to also critically, again, what's that word mean? Criticize. They are also obliged to also critically return to the source of their history, which is their culture and distinct thought and practice traditions that they have developed to sustain and enhance their life worlds and lived experiences. So what Rayland Rabaka is arguing here is that black people need to distance themselves from Western Judeo-Christian capitalist culture and orient themselves to what is their true heritage, which is African. I still have about another 50% of his quote to read, but I have to digress here and say something. With all due respect, do not refer to me as an African American. Don't do that. I'm an American. My ethnicity is black. okay? Feel free to say black around me. I will not get offended. I'm a black man. I'm not an African American man. Now, I know that my, if I were to do a, and I have, DNA history, ancestral history, on my father's side, my paternal history goes back to West Ghana, Guinea-Bissau, in West Africa. But if you were to trace my mother's lineage, I'm Scottish, Irish, English. My great-grandfather was a white Jew on my mother's side. On my father's side, you trace my trace us all the way back to Guinea-Bissau, to the Bolanta people. The Bolanta people were slave owners. They weren't slaves. They were slave owners. This is what Virgil and I love to do. We love to debunk the myths that are out there. You can call us Mythbusters if you want. But I'm not boasting, but we do our homework on this stuff, folks. We do our homework on this stuff. So we read, it's like that line from The Godfather, I think it's Godfather Part 2, where young Michael Corleone says, "My father always taught me to keep your friends close, but your enemies closer." We like to keep our enemies closer. So we read our enemies. We read what our enemies think. For the purpose of arguing and offering a biblical but yet intelligent apologetic against what our enemies believe. This is why I'm quoting these people to you, so you can hear for yourselves what they believe. If you don't know what they believe, how are you going to know how to respond? This is a battle of worldviews, folks. This is well beyond politics. This is well beyond ideology. This is a battle of worldviews. Which is why I say that critical race theory is eschatological, because they want to bring in an entirely new world. Eschaton, the Greek word eschaton, which is where eschatology comes from, it's not just about the end of something. It's about ending one thing and beginning something else. So Ray LaRavaca goes on. He says capitalism and racism, and you see how he associates the two. Capitalism and racism, as with capitalism and sexism, see, capitalism is the fault of everything. Every ism that exists is because of capitalism. Capitalism and racism, as with capitalism and sexism, are inextricable and constantly influencing and exacerbating each other. They are interlocking systems of exploitation, oppression, and violence that conceal a kind of cultural racism deeply embedded in the languages and logics, mores and twisted morals, institutions, and individual imperialist expressions, that's you white people. I'm exempt, but only for a minute. I'll explain. Deeply embedded in the languages and logics, mores and twisted morals, institutions, and individual imperialist expressions of the ruling race, gender, class, religion, and its neo-colonized, quote, colored, unquote, lackeys. So, unquote, by the way. Raymond Rabaka here, he disses white people and people like me. You white people, you are the embodiment of imperialist expressions of the ruling class in terms of race, gender, class, religion, etc., which is why I used the term earlier, white hegemony. That's a fancy way of saying white power. You guys, white domination. But he attacks people like me and Virgil because he says we ride along with you white supremacists, so he refers to us as neo-colonized colored lackeys. That's an ethnic pejorative that says people like Virgil and me, see, we've been neo-colonized. We've been colonized. So I've totally lost sight of my African roots, you see. And remember, he's saying that the goal here is to reconnect that umbilical cord of African diaspora with black people in America. We got to reconnect to that. That's truly who we are. That's truly who I am. So he's lumping me and Virgil, people like me and Virgil, in with you white imperialist supremacists, because we're just carrying your water. So when you hear the term neo-colonized colored lackeys, that's not a compliment. Now, contrary to what may seem the reality on the surface, not all black leaders view socialism with such endearment as Rabaka and San Juan do. For example, Dr. Chuwi Mbetwa sees socialism quite differently, as he asserts in his book titled Why Africa is Poor. Dr. Chuwi Mbetwa says this, quote, "Socialism is not adept at finding solutions to serious problems. Its emphasis on collective responsibility over and above individual responsibility rolls over lingering individual capacity to configure self-extricating measures out of crises." So what Dr. Mbetwa is saying here, socialism leaves no room for the person to help themselves. When he says that socialism doesn't have the capacity to configure self-extricating measures, self-extricating is leaving it up to you to deal with the problem. In the long term, still quoting Dr. Mbetwa, in the long term, it, that is socialism, robs individuals of the opportunity to acquire skills for personal emancipation. I love that phrase, personal emancipation. Socialism, he says, struggles when it attempts to function as a propeller of wealth, unquote. Dr. Mbetwa says socialism struggles when it attempts to function as a propeller of wealth, which is, he's right. I think it brings up an irony here, because you've got socialists and Marxists and communists who are anti-capitalist because capitalism produces wealth for some. But then at the same time, socialists will argue, well, socialism is the way to wealth and prosperity. But what socialists don't tell you is that unlike capitalism, which in terms of wealth is an ideological of advancement, of increase, socialism and Marxism is an ideology of decrease, to where it takes from the haves and gives to the have-nots, and on the basis of what it gives to the have-nots, it calls it increase and ignores the fact that it steals. That's theft. It really is. Socialism is theft. It takes from you simply because you have it. That's egregiously unbiblical. The commandment, thou shalt not steal, inherently recognizes the principle of private property. Meaning, what's yours is not mine. Me calling what's yours mine doesn't make it mine. It's still theft. Now, I've spoken to this point about the ideological connection between critical race theory and Marxism, but there's a chronological connection as well, which I alluded to earlier, and that chronology begins with what is known as critical theory, or CT. So I'm going to take you now through a timeline of how we got to CRT. How did CRT get here? Critical race theory, CT, critical theory, CT, provides a specific interpretation of Marxist philosophy with regards to a critique of mass culture. Also known as the Frankfurt School, critical theory is a philosophical and sociological movement spread across many universities around the world. It was originally located at the Institute for Social Research. Now, the proper name of, you may have heard the term Frankfurt School before, but the proper name of it is critical theory. Critical theory. It was taught at the Institute for Social Research at the Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany, which is why it's sort of shorthanded, referred to as the Frankfurt School. The Institute was founded in 1923 by a wealthy Jewish German Argentine by the name of Felix Weil, W-E-I-L, with the aim of developing Marxist studies in Germany. So the whole purpose of critical theory, the Frankfurt School, was to advance Marxism throughout Germany. But a little hiccup called the Nazis arrived and shut the Institute for Social Research down. Shut it down in the 1930s. So what did the Institute do? Totally resurrected, moved to America. Relocated to America and found hospitality at Columbia University in New York City. Virgil and I are going to be speaking in New York next weekend in the heart of New York. And I'm going to pick on Columbia University in my comments there. Because Columbia University, for all its reputation as being an Ivy League school, which it is, robust academics, absolutely, Columbia has a history of facilitating communist, Marxist, and socialist ideologues. And since I'm going to be, what, a couple blocks from Columbia, might as well endear themselves to me by calling them out for that. So we have CT. Okay, we have CT in the 1930s. Out of CT, several decades later, CT is now at Columbia, now in America. 4 decades later, we're in the 1970s. CT has grown to a movement called Critical Legal Studies. So you have CT, and now you have CLS. As a movement, CLS was comprised predominantly of white neo-Marxist legal scholars who sought to study the impacts of legal jurisprudence in America, but through a Marxist construct of equality and justice. Okay? It was the CLS movement that initiated a shift from Marxism being fundamentally a philosophy of economic class struggle to one of identity struggle, or what I choose to refer to as cultural Marxism. So the CLS movement, this group of Marxist legal academics, gets together. They're reviewing already settled law in America, but they're reproblematizing it through a Marxist paradigm of equality and justice, but specifically with, well, how does this affect black people? So from the CLS movement in the 1970s arose what is known today as critical race theory. So you have CT to CLS, and now we're at CRT. Similar to the CLS movement, the CRT movement began with a group of black neo-Marxist legal scholars who met at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the summer of 1989 with the belief that their predecessors in the CLS movement didn't go far enough to move the dial of civil rights for black people in America. So to put it plainly, the CRT Marxists didn't think that the CLS Marxists were radical enough. So we got to push the envelope even further. As Dr. Daniel Subotnick, professor of law at Truro College of Law in Central Islip, New York, and author of the book Toxic Diversity, subtitled Race, Gender, and Law Talk in America, writes in a white paper published in the Cornell University Journal of Law and Public Policy in the spring of 1998 titled What's Wrong with Critical Race Theory, subtitled Reopening the Case for Middle-Class Values, quote, with the control of race discourse in their hands, crits turned their attention away from the legal academy and toward American culture in general. And this they have done with enthusiasm, developing and then applying new methods for the purpose and scouring the broad landscape of American life. They have found race and racism implicated in a terrifying array of institutions and practices. Whites then, Dr. Sabatna says, whites then stand accused and have remained largely undefended, unquote. So what Dr. Sabatnik here is saying, he's saying here something that I alluded to earlier. So I just said that when you go from CLS to CRT, you change the paradigm of Marxism, which started out as a fundamentally economic proposition, to now it's cultural. So now that it's cultural, Dr. Sabatnik is saying crits can now turn and say that racism is in everything. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. That's what he means when he says that crits have found race and racism implicated in a terrifying array of institutions and practices. When he says they found race and racism implicated, that doesn't mean they have discovered objective evidence of that. It's that they are presupposing, they are criticizing these institutions and practices as being racist. Just by saying so, they don't have to prove it. And he says, whites then stand accused, as I've been saying to you, all of you, if you're white, you're guilty. And you've gone largely undefended, Sabatnik is saying. And it's true. Who's defending you? Nobody. You're guilty by existing. Critical race theory is built upon one. This is hugely important, folks, what I'm about to say. This is hugely important. Critical race theory is built upon one main presuppositional thesis. As I said earlier, if you don't remember anything else, just understand that critical race theory in its totality is presuppositional. It starts with its conclusions. Critical race theory is built upon one main presuppositional thesis that is supported by at least three subordinate yet equally important presuppositional theses. The main presuppositional thesis of critical race theory is that racism is the normal, common, and everyday experience of all people of color in America. That's all you need to know about critical race theory. That is why critical race theory is so dangerous. That is the cornerstone presupposition upon which critical race theory is built. The presupposition, the criticism, that racism is the normal, common, and everyday experience of people of color in America. That is how critical race theory makes its money. That's why people like Ibram X. Kendi can charge $20,000 per appearance to go speak at liberal churches, liberal educational institutions. This is why he can write books and sell millions of copies. Because people accept the presuppositions that he's offering. So that is the foundational presupposition upon which critical race theory rests. The presupposition that racism is the normal experience of all people of color in America. That is all you need to know about critical race theory. Notwithstanding everything else that it entails, it is fundamentally built on that one presupposition. Now, there are at least three subordinate presuppositions that I'm going to cover here in a second. But listen to this as it relates to that main presupposition. Listen to this from the UCLA School of Public Affairs and Critical Race Studies on their website. Quote, this is UCLA spelling out that main presupposition. Quote, CRT recognizes that racism is ingrained in the fabric and system of the American society. The individual, I have to shake my head every time I read this because it's so stupid, this next sentence. The individual racist need not exist to note that institutional racism is pervasive in the dominant culture. Exactly. Somebody said, what? So the first sentence argues the presupposition. First sentence, quoting again, CRT recognizes that racism is ingrained in the fabric and system of the American society. Presupposition, so they sign off on the fundamental presupposition of CRT. Then they follow that up But the individual races need not exist to note that institutional racism is pervasive in dominant culture. So my question is, how does institutional racism exist if there are no individual races? This is why I started the message by saying CRT is not Big Bang Theory, guys. But their argument is as if it is. Poof, it's just, society's just racist, just poof. But the individual races need not exist. So, see, this is where theology comes in. Because you can't have I'll just use the word racism. I hate that word, but I'll use it for the sake of conversation. You can't have racism. You can't have the ism without dealing with the heart. You can't. It's impossible. So this is why all of us who profess to follow Christ, we must be theologians as we argue against this worldview. They're saying racism is ingrained in the fabric and system of American society, but that they're also saying that individual races need not exist. See, what Virgil and I do, and we would encourage you to do the same thing. It's not easy, but we encourage you to do the same thing. You must use, I'm going to talk about this later this afternoon in my second message. You must learn to use biblical vernacular against these worldly ideologies. You must reject the word racism. You must reject it. Biblical is nonsensical. Biblical, what the world calls racism, the Bible simply calls hate. So what makes this nonsensical, I'm not even finished reading the quote yet, what makes this nonsensical is you can't argue that racism exists without getting to the genesis of the ism. You define it, and then you root cause it. But they don't do that here. They just accept the presupposition. Racism is ingrained in the fabric and system of American society, but the individual races need not exist. Well, the Bible argues against that, that nonsense. 1 John chapter 2. If anyone hates his brother, he's a murderer. So you're not, you, matter of fact, if you hate your brother, Scripture says you're worse than a racist. You're a murderer. So you have, again, I have to reiterate this. You must be able to decipher the language that they use. Because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. To finish up with this quote from the UCLA School of Public Affairs and Critical Race Studies. The individual races need not exist to note that institutional racism is pervasive in the dominant culture. This is the analytical lens that CRT uses in examining existing power structures. Number one, that's a lie. Critical race theory doesn't analyze anything. If you're going to assert that critical race theory analyzes anything, what you're doing is implying that analysis, that number one, if it is analysis, that it's subjective. I have a background in statistics. In statistics, 2 + 2 does not equal 5. The reason I was able to fly here today, the reason Virgil was able to fly here today, is because 2 + 2 equals 4. There's nothing analytical about critical race theory. It's critical. It criticizes everything. It doesn't analyze anything. It's presuppositional. CRT, continuing with the quote, finish up here. CRT identifies that these power structures are based on white privilege and white supremacy, which perpetuates the marginalization of people of color. Unquote. Now, personal story. The only marginalization that I've experienced in my life has been by people of color. But UCLA School of Public Affairs and Critical Race Studies, again, it's presuppositional. They're presupposing that only white people have the capacity to marginalize people of color, however they define marginalization. I've never had a white person call me a coon. Never had a white person call me house nigger. Never had a white person call me Uncle Tom. Never had a white person call me bootlicker. Now, I've been called all those names, but I've been called those names by people who look like me. The worst crime, thank you so much. The worst crime you can commit in the culture today is to be a black conservative. That's a cardinal sin. Cardinal sin within black culture and white liberal culture as well. You cannot, you must not think for yourself. You must not. You want to be ostracized, demonized, denigrated? Be a black person who doesn't follow the tribe. Me and Virgil have been called all those names. I think the funniest, though, is when they call us Uncle Tom. I have to laugh at that one. I laugh because it's a phrase out of Harriet Beecher Stowe's book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is one of my favorite books. If you haven't read it, you should. Two books that ought to be in every American's library is Uncle Tom's Cabin and Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery. If you haven't read those two books, and then if you have children, if you've not read those books to your children, shame on you. But what's funny about people who try to label as Uncle Tom's as a ethnic pejorative is if you've read Uncle Tom's Cabin, then you know that Tom is the Christ-like figure who's the hero of the story. So people who label us Uncle Tom, if it's done in person, which is rare, but it's been done, if someone approaches me and accuses me of being Uncle Tom in person, first thing I ask them two questions. Number one, can you read? If they answer yes, I say, well, have you read Harriet Beecher's Uncle Tom's Cabin? I will know if they're lying. Every single time, they've not read it. So I send them along their way. Go take 6 months, probably take you that long to read it. Go take 6 months out of your life and read Harriet Beecher Stowe, then hit me up. But every single time we've been marginalized, listen, I've been held up at gunpoint twice in my life. Each time was by a young black teenager. So when UCLA talks about power structures that are based on white privilege and white supremacy that perpetuates the marginalization of people of color, lies. Black culture is probably the most hate-filled, racist, divisive culture that exists in America today. We murder one another like there's no tomorrow. We abort our babies like there's no tomorrow. And this UCLA wants to talk to me about white supremacy, marginalization of people of color. It's a lie. So that's the main presuppositional thesis of critical race theory. Race is endemic to every aspect of American life. And understand, when they're defining race, it's a moving target. It's a moving target. It is social. It's not biological or scientific. That is the primary thesis upon which critical race theory makes its money. To again quote Dr. Dan Subotnick from his book, Toxic Diversity, quote, remember, as you listen to this quote, listen to this quote against the backdrop of understanding that critical race theory is presuppositional. Dr. Subotnick says this. He says, quote, if race is central because racial supremacy is central to American culture, which is what Chris argued, which is precisely what critical race theory asserts, then all features of American culture are presumed tainted. In such an environment, racism can be presumed and need not be proved. That's how crits get away with it. They argue that all features of American culture are presumed tainted with racism, But they get away with the presumption because they don't have to prove anything. This is why I have a problem with the book Divided by Faith, because what it is, it's filled with statistics that say, well, these differences are disparities. But again, if it's a disparity, show me first where we all started on an equal playing field, and then show me what happened that created the disparity. That's why I have a problem with that book. And that book sold millions of copies. Churches ate that thing up like they were eating oatmeal or something. They ate that book up. They were doing Bible studies. It's the same thing with Tisby's book on race, Kendi's book, How to Be Anti-Racist. Churches are eating this stuff up. But see, this is why you as a white person, this is why you have it hard. You have it hard because all the crits need to do is get a bullhorn or get on CNN, get on MSNBC, and what you'll notice is those media outlets, they'll try to find the most angry, ugly, I mean temperamentally ugly, visceral black person that they can find to come on and speak on behalf of people like us. The Afro has become the new symbol of subject matter expertise. Let's just find somebody with an Afro, like a Colin Kaepernick. You notice how when Colin went through his woke transformation, first thing he did was then he went, this ain't new, folks. It's like Ecclesiastes said, there's nothing new under the sun. Nothing new under the sun. This is the same symbolism of James Cone in the 1970s in the Black Power movement. It's just recycled. So I've given you the main presupposition of critical race theory. Here are at least three supporting presuppositional theses, which are these. Number one, so the main presupposition is supported by this. Number one is called interest convergence or material determinism. Interest convergence. The interest convergence thesis argues that racism benefits and advances the interests of white people always and only at the expense of black people. So another term within critical race theory is what's called zero sum. Zero sum is that you as a white person get your advantage at my expense. So I had to lose something in order for you to gain something. Second is what's called social construction thesis. The social construction thesis. Is that a signal that I've gone over? Man, that's cold, bro. They shut me off, man. The social construction thesis. So you had interest convergence, then the social construction thesis. The social construction thesis holds that race and races are products of social thought and relation. This is exactly what Karl Marx believed. Karl Marx, who, by the way, was a racist. He was a Jew who hated Jews. Karl Marx hated Jews. He hated blacks. He hated Asians. He had a visceral hatred of these people. Social construction thesis says that races and races are products of social thought and relation, not fixed biological or scientific realities. Okay? That's why the goalposts are always moving. That's why everything is racist. Because it's a societal definition. Everything is racist. I'll talk about that more this afternoon. Thirdly, the voice of color thesis. So you got interest convergence, social construction, and then voice of color, or VOC. Voice of color thesis holds that ethnic minorities are better suited to talk about systemic oppression and marginalization. Okay? In other words, if you're white, you don't have the right to say anything because you're the problem to begin with. So you just need to just shut up and listen. One example of this is
the DEI movement, the diversity, equity, and inclusion movement. This is especially going on in corporate America. Where I'm from in Atlanta, Coca-Cola's headquartered in Atlanta, has been from day one. They're employing DEI to their employees. We've seen Coke cans with the words, "Be less white." This is corporate training at Coca-Cola right now, teaching their white employees how to be less white. DEI, SEL, social emotional learning. Marxist educators are now trying to rebrand critical race theory as culturally responsive training. Still CRT. Don't be fooled. DEI is critical race theory. SEL is critical race theory. Culturally responsive teaching is critical race theory. Critical race theory is a stealth ideology. And what I mean by that is they're not going to come out and tell you, yeah, we're teaching critical race theory. They're going to camouflage it. They're going to mask it. It's just like Satan, who disguises himself as what? An angel of light. This is what crits are doing. That's what makes it demonic. That's what makes it so satanic, because it's disguising itself as something else. But unless you know what to look for. So main presuppositions, racism's everywhere. Underneath that, you have interest convergence, social construction, and voice of color. Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanczyk, two of today's most influential critical race theorists, acknowledge that, quote, critical race theory builds on the insights of two previous movements, critical legal studies and radical feminism. That ought to tell you all you need to know right there. To both of which it owes a large debt. It also draws from certain European philosophers and theorists such as Antonio Gramsci, Michel Foucault, and Jacques Derrida. Unquote. But in saying that, in saying all that, what Delgado and Stefanczyk don't tell you is that all three of those men were Marxists. They're crediting three Marxists. Antonio Gramsci, Michel Foucault, and Jacques Derrida. Delgado and Stefanczyk described them as European philosophers and theorists. But Gramsci, Foucault, and Derrida were Marxists. In fact, Antonio Gramsci is widely regarded today as the godfather of cultural Marxism. In the book, The Devil and Karl Marx, Dr. Paul Kengor, professor of political science at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, makes the following assessment of today's culture against the backdrop of Marxism in the chapter titled Fundamental Transformation. Where have we heard that phrase before? In that chapter, Kengor writes this, quote, please listen closely, especially those of you who are educators. Quote, in a crucial respect, classical Marxism and cultural Marxism will always bear an essential, enduring commonality, one that explains a lot about today's modern left. Both classical Marxists and cultural Marxists see history as a series of struggles that divide the world into hostile slash antagonistic groups of oppressors and the oppressed. Both seek out victim groups as the anointed group that will also serve as society's redeemer group. The victim group becomes the agent for emancipation in ushering in the new and better world. See, I said it was eschatological. The Marxist must always then be on the search for the newest victim class, which in turn must always be made aware of its victimization. Its consciousness must be raised. In classical Marxism, this was simple. The victim group was identified by class economics. It was the proletariat. It was the factory worker. In cultural Marxism, this has not been so simple because the culture is always changing. the victim group is constantly being searched for anew by the cultural Marxists. They are looking less for factory workers than cultural workers. Forget the factory floor. That project failed long ago. The new recruiting ground is the classroom floor. That project, the classroom floor, the campus, the university, the schools. That is where the cultural workers who can usher in the fundamental transformation are being sought and are being found. These modern cultural revolutionaries are succeeding magnificently in redefining everything from marriage and family to sexuality and gender. This is where today's Marxists in America and the West are toiling hard. They are working diligently on the cultural front. That is where they are confident that they can finally take down the West and its Judeo-Christian bedrock that Marx and a long line of disciples looked to smash, unquote. Critical race theory is unbiblical for at least the following five reasons. One, it categorizes image bearers of God into groups for the purpose of causing division and antagonistic class struggle. That's against Genesis 1:27, Genesis 5:2, and Titus 3, verses 10 and 11. It categorizes image bearers of God into groups for the purpose of causing division and antagonistic class struggle. Reason number two, critical race theory imparts sinful motives to certain of God's image bearers solely on the basis of the color of their skin. That's Acts 17:26. It imparts sinful motives to certain of God's image bearers solely on the basis of the color of their skin. Number three, critical race theory transfers the guilt of presumed sins of those from past generations to those of present generations. It's what I call sin by proxy. So if you're white sitting here today, you're guilty by proxy of the presumed sins of your ancestors that your ancestors committed against people who look like me. That's sin by proxy. Reason number four, critical race theory is rooted in the sin of ethnic partiality. That's a violation of James chapter 2, verse 9. It's rooted in the sin of ethnic partiality. And number five, critical race theory promotes materialistic covetousness and envy under the false pretense of justice and equity. That's Exodus 20:17, Ezekiel 18:20, John 6:27, and 1 John 2, verses 9 through 11. Now, there is much more about critical race theory that I wanted to share with you today, but in the interest of time, I must close here. But as I close, I want to share with you this account from the book Jesus in Beijing by Dr. David Aikman, which I believe provides some much-needed context in light of what I've shared with you today in terms of the influence of Marxism on critical race theory and its disdain for capitalism. David Aikman writes in his book, Jesus in Beijing, the 18 American tourists visiting China weren't expecting much from the evening's scheduled lecture. They were already exhausted from a day of touring Beijing, but what the speaker had to say astonished them. He said, quote, one of the things we were asked to look into was what accounted for the success, in fact, the preeminence of the West all over the world. We studied everything we could from the historical, political, economic, and cultural perspective. At first, we thought it was because you had more powerful guns than we had. Then we thought it was because you had the best political system. Next, we focused on your economic system. But in the past 20 years, we have realized that the heart of your culture is your religion, Christianity. That is why the West has been so powerful. The Christian moral foundation of social and cultural life was what made possible the emergence of capitalism and then the successful transition to democratic politics. We don't have any doubt about this. Unquote. So, to wrap up, is critical race theory compatible with Christianity? Let me answer that question by reading to you a passage from an article titled Christianity or Critical Theory by Dr. Eric B. Watson, Senior Pastor of Harvest Orthodox Presbyterian Church in San Marcos, California. This article is published, by the way, in the October 2021 issue of Table Talk Magazine, if you can get your hands on that. October 2021 issue of Table Talk Magazine, published by Ligonier Ministries. Dr. Watkins, in his article, Christianity or Critical Theory, writes this, quote, is critical theory's worldview compatible with Christianity? This is an important question. While it may be possible to find Christians who endorse critical theory, it is nearly impossible to find critical theorists who endorse Christianity. This is because Christianity is an overarching system of thought that seeks to define reality and posits objective moral values. According to critical theory, Christianity fosters unsafe ideologies and institutions that perpetuate anti-scientific thought, intolerance for certain sexual behaviors, parochialism, patriarchy, and a punishing authoritarianism for any who do not conform. Pre-Enlightenment Christianity is seen as stuck in the dark ages of intellectual barbarism, and the post-Enlightenment church is viewed as perpetuating colonialism, racism, sexism, chauvinism, and homophobia. Critical theory is critical of virtually all worldviews, including Christianity. Its goal is human autonomy from any objective authority whatsoever. Unquote. So contrary to what many Marxist crits and black liberation theologians would have you believe, critical race theory is not merely some innocuous, innocent way of promoting anti-racism or of teaching people about the history of racism in America or of understanding how the power dynamics of white supremacy have operated in this nation. To prove that point, let me close with this. I'm going to quote to you right now a comment made by Teresa Montaño. Teresa Montaño is an educator with the group Liberated Ethnic Studies. It's an organization called Liberated Ethnic Studies. To prove my point that critical race theory is not some innocuous, innocent way of teaching history, listen to this. I'm quoting Teresa Montaño from the group Liberated Ethnic Studies, who says, quote, ethnic studies is more than pedagogy and content. Ethnic studies is about creating change in the community. And what you will see in the lessons that follow are how classroom teachers begin to use critical race theory connected to ethnic studies in a way to empower and to create social justice activists out of our students. Unquote. There is nothing innocuous about critical race theory. Critical race theory is an all-encompassing worldview, one that is steeped in cultural Marxism and that shares the same teleological ends as that which I quoted earlier from Dr. Paul Kengor, namely the takedown of the West and its Judeo-Christian bedrock. It's been my distinct honor and privilege to be with you today. Thank you all very much. Thank you.